Music from Lenny LeBlanc. It's called The Rain. And it is 14 minutes after the hour. It is a Tuesday morning here along the Broken Road. And we've got Dr. Don Clark on the line. Dr. Don, our resident biochemist and a member of the board at Creation Moments. And Don joins us just about every Tuesday morning. We talk about science and faith and creation and evolution and such things. And Don, good morning. How's the grape branch going down there in Garden Valley, Texas?
Well, they're... We're waiting for cooler weather, actually. We got a little bit of cooler weather now. As of yesterday, we had some rain, and then it started to cool off. So it's probably won't get into the 80s today.
Oh heavens.
Which is nice.
We won't get there either if it makes you feel better. We won't get to the 80s either today up here in East Dakota.
Won't. No, okay.
No. we won't get to the 70s. We might get to the 60s, yeah. That's the way it works. Well, the grapes at this time of the year, I mean, the picking's done, right?
Oh, here, the picking's been done, yes, since August. So,
excuse me, the harvest, you harvest grapes, you don't pick grapes, do you?
Well, yes, to pick grapes, you'd have to pick them, each berry off the rachis, off the stem, which would be quite a task.
Yeah,
it's hard enough just cutting the the grapes.
So your team of workers, your team of grape soldiers, your wranglers, grape wranglers, have little tools and they cut a hole. Do they cut a whole bunch off at once when they do that?
No, you cut off each bunch. Yeah, you cut off a bunch.
Okay.
Typically at a time. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the bunches are different sizes. Sometimes you get a nice... full cluster, and sometimes they're not as big. But,
and then what do you do with it? Because these things are fragile. You wouldn't throw them into like a big bin because they'd be crushed on the bottom. How do you have to preserve them till you get them into some other building or container?
Well, we typically use picking lugs, which can hold about 30 to 35 pounds, 38 pounds of grapes. And then those, if you're going to transport them a long distance, you would put them in macro bins, which would hold about 1,000 pounds or a half a ton of grapes. And sometimes you can throw in a little metabisulfite to help retard the fermentation process, because it will start if the grapes get crushed, which they do.
And, yeah, on the bottom.
You know, at the bottom, then fermentation could start. But if you process them relatively quickly, which is the best way to do it, then you don't usually have a problem with pre-fermentation. Well,
I always like to learn a little bit about the wine industry as we'll join the conversation this morning. We've got an interesting article to discuss. This is an article from the Institute of Creation Research, and let me set the scene here. You're somewhere 80 to 100 miles east of Israel in the Arabian Desert. You're an archaeologist, and you're digging in a cave, and you see human remains, and you see animal remains, and you begin to wonder. You look around you, and you say, "Oh, look at the desert! It's dry, it's barren here. There are scorpions, and there are snakes, and all kinds of desert dwellers. Surely these people were desert dwellers and adept at desert living." You could be wrong.
Well, you certainly could be wrong, especially if your time frame is let's say 3,500 years earlier. That desert wasn't a desert at all, and matter of fact, it was a very lush area. It's called the Azraq Oasis. There is still an oasis there, so there's a little bit of water. But earlier in man's history, it was quite lush. And it supported all kinds of life. There were all different types of animals, all kinds of animals were there, gazelles, camels, wild cattle, for example, horses and elephants, rhinos, even lions and other carnivores.
Would this area have been included in what we call the Fertile Crescent? And if it was a Fertile crescent, it must have been fertile. In other words, like things growing there.
Well, of course it was. It was quite fertile, actually. Mm-hmm. This is we're talking about Jordan, obviously, and the area now. If you go into Jordan, and back in 2008, Andre and I took a trip to Israel, and one of the side trips was to go to Petra. And you go to Petra today, as you get into Jordan, when you leave Israel and go into Jordan, it is a barren, barren place. And you say to yourself, how could anyone possibly live in this area, in this place? And the more you drive into Jordan, the drier it gets. And the only green is where these oases are. And it's just a little patch of green, and everything else is, I mean, it is barren, as you described, completely barren. And you get to Petra and you say, man, this is a dry place. How could anybody live there? Well, apparently Petra too was also quite green, and there's, of course, evidence within as you go into the kind of the key into Petra itself, and the big, very, very tall sandstone walls. They actually made trenches along the side of the wall for bringing water into the city. And there is a stream at the mouth of Petra that actually was gushing with water at one point in time. So even Petra was not barren at all, but could support quite a bit of life. And so this area of the Azrek oasis not only could support a tremendous amount of life, but it was a lake at one point in time. And so you had rains and actually ice and snow and hailstorms that we know of from a historical record book, actually. Some people wouldn't necessarily call it a historical record, but that's exactly what it is, because it's the Book of Job. And Job, in the Book of Job, for example, describes this area. For example, it says, from whose womb did the ice come forth, and who has given birth to the frost of heavens? So that's in Job 38:29. And there's several references in Job, actually, to ice or to frozen water and to snow. And in Psalm 147:17, for example, he hurls down to his crystals of ice like crumbs. Who can stand before his cold? Obviously talking about hailstorm. Mm-hmm. The area was not only quite livable, but at times could be quite cold.
Now, Job is purported to be the oldest book of the Bible that is written before anything else was written down. Do you hold to that?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. Job is the oldest book. It even came before Genesis, because we know that at least, of course, you know, Moses is attributed to writing down Genesis, of course, and so Job came before Moses, as well as he came before Abraham or Abram. He was obviously one of the ones that found favor with God, and this was after the Tower of Babel, because if we look at biblical history and look at the events after the flood, we know that people migrated to the Shinar Valley, which was where the Tower of Babel was, or where Babel was, and of course there were three cities surrounding that area, which that area later it became Babylon. We know that God confused the languages of the people so they wouldn't build this tower up to heaven. Not that he was worried that they were getting up to heaven, but it was because of the religious activity that was going on there, which Nimrod was a man, for example, who it says in Genesis that he was a mighty hunter. Well, it turns out that not only was he a mighty hunter, but he was a mighty hunter of men. And his whole goal in life was to turn men's hearts away from the Creator God. And so this tower was an effort to reach up into heaven to destroy God, if you will. I mean, as ridiculous as that may sound, and to take as many men with him as possible. This kind of sounds like perhaps his spiritual father, which of course was Lucifer, and so he was obviously inspired by Lucifer and the Babylonian religion, the Babel religion. And in Revelation, we read about the mystery Babylon, which of course is still quite active in the world today. It had its origins in Babel. Well, after God confused the languages, for example, then people started to migrate away from the area. And as you may recall, God said, you know, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. Well, if you're building a city and if you're building this big tower, everybody is congregated in one place. So they weren't doing what God actually told them to do. And so by confusing their languages, he essentially forced them to move apart. And so groups of people started moving apart. Well, one group obviously moved south into the Jordan area. But let's look at what the weather or what the climate was like after the flood. Well, we know that, for example, because of the warm waters and the cold land, that was ideal for the Ice Age. The classic definition, if you will, or the classic understanding of the Ice Age is that it happened millions and millions of years ago when there were many, many ice ages that happened about every 10 million years you had an ice age. Well, that doesn't fit with how in the world do you start an ice age in the beginning? Well, you need warm water, so something had to be the earth had to be temperate, for example, before the ice age, and then after a major catastrophic event, which of course we know as the flood, then something was happening, that. Also, when the flood was going on, of course, the continents were breaking apart, and we have a lot of evidence as to the continents breaking apart. And
that's something that even secular science, established science, concurs with, that there was one continent on the Earth that they have named Pangaea, and that it broke apart into the continents we see today.
Right, and the thing that we disagree with, the creationists disagree with the secular geologists, for example, is the speed at which the continents broke apart. And apparently, it happened very, very quickly, as opposed to, well, look, the continents are moving quite slowly right now. And so if we take that rate and we use that rate and figure out how long it took if you reverse the process, how long would it take for the continents to come back together? You get, obviously, very, very long time periods, but you're not taking into account that if the Earth is breaking up, then you're going to have a lot of volcanic activity where the rifts are, for example, in the middle of the ocean, and that is going to cause molten material to be sliding under the continents, which is going to stay molten and give the continents a much smoother, almost like lubrication, for example, to move apart and to move away. And so that's what it seems the best model at. If you assume, and you're not even assuming because it's a recorded history, if you use the recorded history that is in Genesis, for example, and then you come up with a model that says, hey, these continents moved apart very, very quickly, and it didn't take them long. Well, long is relative because now we're looking at maybe 500 to... I mean, less than that for the continents to move apart. But obviously, after Noah and his three sons and their wives and his wife, after the ark landed in the mountains of Ararat, and the after the that year of the flood, then you know they. The door was open. They had dry land. Then they started migrating. Well, as I said, they migrated. Most of the people migrated to this area called the Plains of Shinar, which then became Babylon. But climate-wise, what was going on is that during that time and afterwards, for quite some time, probably 500 to 700 years afterwards, you had... this event, which we call the Ice Age, taking place. You had the warmer waters, you had the drier, the colder land because of all this volcanic activity throwing up volcanic dust. Then that cooled down the land. It was perfect conditions for developing a lot of snow, which, of course, developed into ice as it packed down. One would expect then the further away you get from the poles, the warmer it's going to, the warmer it's going to be. And here was a region, for example, getting back to Jordan and Israel, mm-hmm. here was a region that was much more temperate than the rest of the climate. So peoples would have naturally migrated to this area, and Babel was one of those regions as well, that was much more not only fertile but temperate, and a lot of vegetation, a lot of animals would be there. And as it says in this little reference to the journal article in archaeology science, archaeological science, that it was these were ice age like remains, which fits perfectly with the biblical model, at least the biblical creation model that I just described. So. It seems that, the more we find, the more we dig, the more evidence we have for the biblical history record, mm-hmm. and the less evidence we have for these long, long time periods and this process that we call evolution.
We've in the past we used to talk regularly with the pastor John Delancey from Pennsylvania, who is an amateur archaeologist, and we would talk just about every week on archaeological finds in the Middle East, specifically in Israel. And he'd made many, many trips over there and participated in many digs. One of the comments he was one of the things he taught us is that there's as much art involved in archaeology as there is science. And one of the problems, the handicaps to really cementing and proving your ideas, because he said that every archaeologist goes in there with an agenda. He's not just looking to discover what he can discover. Many are going to either prove the Bible or disprove the Bible or other theories in archaeology. But one of the drawbacks is archaeologists don't talk to each other. Much less do archaeologists talk to geologists, talking to paleontologists, talking to chemists, talking to physicists. In other words, there was no coordinated database for all the finds and all the information so that apt conclusions could be drawn. Hence, a lot of confusion about what existed there in the past and when it existed. When do you suppose Job lived? Now, you've described the flood and the breakup of the continents and the ice age due to the volcanic activity, and so there was snow and there was ice. That would suggest, as the ice age was ending, that as the as the glaciers were retreating, there would be running water everywhere and green things growing and animals moving around. This could have been a very livable place, but we're talking, what, maybe 2000 BC, 3000 BC, something in that neighborhood?
Well, if you take the biblical timeline, you know, as face value, then the flood happened about 4,400 to 4,500 years mm-hmm. ago, and that would put Job around 3,500 years or 1,000 years, 900 to 1,000 years after the flood,
mm-hmm.
Which would make sense because we would still see signs, let's say, of the remnant of the Ice Age. Maybe as far out as 700 years, and things still wouldn't have warmed up as they are today for quite some time. So that would actually fit, you know, fit nicely. So, yeah, about, you know, 1500 BC, 2000 BC, that, you know, these things were taking place, and Job was there. It's interesting that in this article, for example, they as you were saying, your presuppositions means a lot in archaeology.
Mm-hmm.
But not only did the team uncover these Ice Age-like remains of these animals, but they also found evidence, for example, duck-specific protein residue on sharp stones used, obviously, for killing and maybe carving up, you know, roasted duck, for example. Evidence of, they say, evidence of some human-like group, and they call them hominids because they don't want to call them humans, because if they call them humans, they're presupposing that, hey, maybe humans lived a long time ago.
This would be the evolutionist view where somehow these were more primitive precursors to human beings.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And they weren't primitive at all. I mean, they were making tools. They were killing animals. They were eating. They were, I don't know if they were farming, but they were certainly hunters. You know, it points to the fact that these were fully human beings.
Well, the book of Job describes a fairly advanced kind of civilization with the things we would recognize today, farms and flocks and hills and mansions and classes of people, you know, rich and poor. So it's impossible, at least unlikely for us to look at what we see now in across Egypt and northern Africa and other portions of the Middle East and think that civilization flourished there. How could civilization flourish in such barren conditions? Well, the obvious answer is, and just logic dictates, it wasn't always barren.
Yes, it wasn't. It wasn't always barren, and these folks not only, you know, obviously found evidence that it wasn't barren. And the only thing that we are really discussing here is the timeline, because if you come with an evolutionary timeline, then you're looking at millions of years, and so millions and millions and millions of years ago. And so these folks, these tools that were made, couldn't have possibly been made by humans, because they hadn't fully developed. You know, by that time. But all of the evidence is pointing to not only were they very smart people, but they made their tools and they learned to survive in a post-flood, you know, era, a post Ice Age era, if you will, and apparently did it quite well.
I remember reading it was a year or two ago about the Queen of Sheba, and of course the Bible tells us the queen of this rich kingdom came north to visit and spend time with King Solomon, and the mystery has been, well, where did she come from? Where could such a kingdom have existed? And what I was reading was research about the country of Yemen, and an area of Yemen that is now absolute bone dry desert. and inhabited by Bedouins and tribal chieftains and you know, just the typical kind of desert environment we think about. We connect with the Middle East. But it said back in those days, there was a system of rivers that had been dammed that created a lush, green country, which was called historically Sheba in that area. And it's where Yemen is now. And that speaks to even more recent climate change, because that would have been 900 BC about, so maybe 3,000 years ago. It was again, lush and green and productive and fertile, and a civilization flourished there that does not appear today. So we can't look at what we see today and just assume that it's always been that way.
Well, and that's absolutely correct. And so you have to, the earth leaves its telltale signs, and it leaves it in the rocks. It leaves it in the sandstone. Just like if you go, you know, east of the Pecos, for example, mm-hmm. I mean, west of the Pecos, the whole area, west in this country, you know, just screams the flood and screams evidence of the flood. You folks have evidence of the flood up where you are. Mm-hmm. So if we're not blinded by the fact that, hey, maybe things weren't the same as they are today, then it would be easy to understand, for example, taking, as I said before, the history book, which is, a lot of chapters and books in the Bible that are history books and are recorded as such. And so if you take that information and use it, then you can, that will help explain the things that you see today.
Well, another way to look at that is if you accept the biblical timeline, a lot of pieces fall into place that otherwise constitute mysteries and dilemmas and unanswered questions when you try to force evolution on the system. If you accept that biblical timeline, it begins to take shape and look very, very logical and natural.
Well, and that's the case. That is correct. And even climate change, for example, you know, we're blaming man for climate change. Oh, for goodness sakes. You know, for example, when Joseph, interpreted the dream to say that, okay, we're going to have 7 years of plenty and 7 years of famine. And the famine wasn't only in Egypt. It was that whole area. So it was Egypt and everything west or east of Egypt and all of that area, up into Israel, which is now Israel. All of that Canaan area, all of that area was barren, was dry. So climate was even changing, back then. And, of course, Elijah... when he prayed and he shut up the heavens for 3.5 years to make a point, that was a dramatic situation as well. I mean, you could point to that and say, there's climate change. And that was obviously caused by man. It was caused by one man. Well, no, Elijah didn't do it. It was God that did it. But mm-hmm. It was probably, something in the climate. As I said, the further away you got from the Ice Age, things started to warm up in the area, and you had periods of time where it was actually quite dry and quite barren. And God had mercy, actually, not only on the people of Israel or Abraham and his clan, but actually had mercy on all of the people of that region, because he prepared Egypt, he prepared Joseph, and he prepared Egypt in that kingdom to help supply the food that was necessary to get the people through that area. That, to me, speaks of a very, very merciful God. I mean, he knows that these things are coming, and he prepares people so that ultimately, obviously, the main purpose was to get Israel back into the land of Canaan. But, in so doing, he also spared the people that were around them.
That's a very powerful argument against deism, that God created us and turned his back and now doesn't care. I think it's obvious to the least casual observer, as we would say, that he's thoroughly involved with his creation, and he loves it and cares for it and manages it. And as we're fond of saying as Christians, he remains on the throne. He's the guy in charge here.
Yeah, very, very much so. And he doesn't leave us alone. He's not leaving us alone. He doesn't leave us, you know, didn't leave man alone back then. And he's certainly not leaving us alone, you know, right now. Miracles still happen. And he's very, very much interested in what's happening to us here on Earth.
Well, I would invite folks to read this article. It's at the Institute for Creation Research, and it's an article by Brian Thomas. And it's entitled "Archaeology Confirms Genesis and the Job Climate." It says Job Climate. That's my first. No, it's Job. It's Job. And you can enjoy the article. It doesn't take too long, but it's food for thought for a good long time, I promise you. Dr. Dunn, we're so grateful. Dr. Dunn, a member of the board at Creation Moments. I want to remind you, too, that you can link to the Creation Moments website from ours. It's at creationmoments.org. I'm sorry, .com. It's a .com, creationmoments.com. And take a look at the wealth of resources they have there for your small group studies and your church libraries. And it's a fascinating website. And Dr. Dunn, we'll see you next week, okay?
Very good. You folks have a great week.
Appreciate your time. Thank you. Take care.
You too, Don.
Bye-bye.